Hello, friends. I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast adventure to discover the entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join us on tonight's episode when my guest Wes Hurley says...
Oh, and the bus plunged from the bridge and fell onto our neighbors. Like we literally came back from a movie. There's, like, reporters on our lawn, and there's a bus sticking out of our neighbor's apartment building.
Oh, my God.
The topic is 80s movies, Diana Ross, and Ben de la Creme. My guest this week is Wes Hurley, creator of the incredible web series Capitol Hill. Season 2 of the show just premiered on YouTube this week, and it's laden with references from all across the broad landscape of American popular culture. Growing up in Vladivostok, Russia, American movies and TV shows floated to Wes through secretive, often illegal channels, and they gave him hope that maybe someday he wouldn't have to walk a mile for clean water, or carry a knife to school, or find human remains washing past his house in a flood. Bootleg American movies kept his spirits up, but when he and his mother were finally able to escape to the United States, they found the country wasn't quite what he'd been led to expect.
Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. Today I'm talking to Wes Hurley, filmmaker from Seattle. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you
for having me. So tell me, what is the entertainment that changed your life?
When I was a kid in Russia, watching American movies really changed my life. A lot of really cheesy movies like Curly Sue in particular, I remember having a big impact.
Describe for me like the plot of Curly Sue.
So the plot of Curly Sue, which is kind of unwatchable now when I try to watch it, but I loved it so much back in Russia. The plot of Curly Sue is a homeless man who's raising a little girl. They prank or con rich people into basically pretending that they're being run over by a rich person's car, and then get them to give them cash. Mm-hmm. And they meet this wealthy, cold, frigid lawyer played by Kelly Lynch, I think, and she falls for the homeless guy and kind of adopts him and the little girl, and they move in with her, and it's very inspirational.
You're a man. She's a woman. Bubba, bubba.
Give us a kiss.
Please. We're in public.
May I?
Me what?
Kiss your cheek.
In a pig's eye.
So you were watching this as like a young kid growing up in Russia, and we were like, oh, and that's what America's like.
Yeah, it was just, I think we were kind of in a dark place, and it was such a positive, light, kind of hopeful movie.
Yeah, describe the town where you were growing up.
So I grew up in Vladivostok, which is far, far east, and is kind of considered the armpit of Russia. I don't know if it's true anymore, probably is. So it's just really, really run down and poor, and a lot of crime, and really long outages of water and electricity, and so just kind of really backward and depressing.
So not a lot of like resources or culture, or like it wasn't a kind of place where you're like, there, I have everything I want.
Definitely no culture there now.
But it also sounds like it was a real hardship, like if you're having outages of like basic things.
Yeah, there was a, I mean, we had no water most of the time, so I would like go for several, sometimes like a mile, with buckets of water and bring home, and then we would boil them manually on like a gas stove. Mm-hmm. To if we wanted to take a bath, for example, or wash dishes or anything like that. So wow. Stuff like that.
And so, like, how old are you? Like, you're carrying buckets of water.
The outages got really bad, I think, around the time I was in middle school, and continued until I left for the States around 16 years old. So
did you feel like, was it a safe place, or was it like, did you feel dangerous?
Oh, it was super dangerous. Mm-hmm. I mean, the schools were overrun with like gangs and just miscellaneous thugs. There was always ambulances outside of my school.
Wow. It
was
so, like, a lot of
really life. Unsafe. I actually carried a giant butcher knife.
Really?
In my backpack.
Oh my God.
For many, many years,
just in case. Did you ever need it?
It just made me feel safer. But I've had other before that, I actually had people pull knife on me in school many times in front of teachers. And it's just like, it's just not, it's kind of was considered norm there. It was very post-apocalyptic landscape. A lot of construction that never got finished. So it actually had that look of like, like the apocalypse that happened. Yeah.
Like just things like kind of falling over, never finished.
Yeah. We had this huge cemetery literally across the street from us up the hill. People just decided to totally get rid of it and build garages on top of it.
Oh, my God.
So they just dug stuff up, left it up, and then we had a flood. And so I remember as a little kid, we were just running around. There's like bones and skeletons, and there's this huge like river going down our main street with like skulls and things. And we'd pick them up, and my dog would like pick them up, and we're just like playing among this like...
Oh my God. It's the Tim Burton-est thing I've ever heard of.
Yeah, it was pretty messed up. I mean, some stuff was interesting as a kid, kind of entertaining, but not good.
Yeah, wow. So I guess the movies must have been a real escape for you guys.
Yeah, movies were a huge escape. I actually saw a movie, and I'm sorry for digressing, but yesterday saw a movie called Chuck Norris versus Communism. Which is amazing, and it talks about the same thing happening in Romania, where this pirated American films of uneven quality made it to Romania, but all of them, including really bad films, like they had such a huge impact on people and like really in various ways were so subversive.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing, because like Curly Sue is not like, you know, it's not fine filmmaking, it's not like a great movie like with a message. And like, if you asked an American about it, they'd be like, oh, I don't even remember that. But, you know, I can see how like when you're in a dark place, seeing something like from that just comes from literally the other side of the world that feels like a million miles away, how that would really be like, okay, well, it's not all like this.
Yeah. I mean, that's very much, Curly Sue is very much a Cinderella story too. Mm-hmm. So I think that's definitely the film that really inspired us to like look into leaving Russia coming to America.
Where did you get movies from? Like, how did you get them?
At first, you would just hear about movies that other people saw, that people who knew people who knew people saw. Like, the first bunch of American movies I actually didn't see. Mm-hmm. I would get a secondhand account of them from like my mom or somebody who had a brother who had a VHS player and a pirated tape of like Predator or wow. Star Wars. And so they would retell you the story in like detail, and people would just pass those stories on. And then
there's something kind of wonderful about the idea of someone passing the story of Predator on through like oral tradition.
No, it's really, I think it's kind of beautiful thing in terms of just people communicating and also, you know, sort of changing the story.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because when I finally got to see a lot of those films, they weren't at all like what I expected. You know, after the fall of Soviet Union, we started to see like pirated tapes that were sold pretty much in the open. Mm-hmm. They would have kiosks, and the tapes would have, they were just like homemade tapes with like homemade stickers, and they would always have two movies on them, and they were completely random combinations of movies, like Pretty Woman and like, you know, some Chuck Norris movie or like some, like it was so random. So that started to happen. And then we also, like locally, we had this Renegade channel number 3. So we had, growing up, we only had like one government channel and then two government channels, and they only would show like, you know, government news and sometimes like an old man playing the piano, classical music. It was just horrible. There was nothing on those channels. And on holidays, you would have like a holiday classic film that they would show every day. But other than that, there was nothing on TV.
The old man playing the piano channel.
No, like literally, yeah. And I remember this was really magical. We started to hear from people like, hey, did you check out channel number 3? Like, turn your thing. And you had those dials on TV back then, you know? So it wasn't buttons. And I remember I ran home and I dialed to number 3, and there was a channel that was like literally like a Renegade channel started by some local out of somebody's basement. I don't know. I don't know who those people. Yeah. And they would broadcast American movies. And at first they would broadcast them just at night, like really late at night. So you would have to wait until like midnight. And they would show like 3 or 4 in a row. The first one I saw was Ghost.
What's the matter?
Seems like whenever anything good in my life happens, I'm just afraid I'm going to lose it.
I really love you.
Which, of course, was just, like, so amazing and magical to see. And everybody, you know, everybody the next day was talking about that. And
oh, my God. I was like, did you see Ghost?
And I remember I saw Labyrinth that way. I saw, like,
Wow, what an amazing way to see Labyrinth. Like this like mysterious thing that just kind of floats to you from somewhere.
Yeah, it was so interesting.
It's such a magical movie.
I've brought you a gift.
What is it?
It's a crystal. Nothing more. But if you turn it this way, look into it, it'll show you your dreams. But this is not a gift for an ordinary girl who takes care of a screaming baby. Do you want it?
Yeah, and there were, again, those were pirated movies. Like, they were they were dubbed by some guy who would basically plug his nose like this so that he had distorted voice, supposedly so people couldn't recognize him.
So was it always the same guy narrating every movie?
It was a couple of guys, maybe two or three people, and they would dub every character.
So you got used to hearing the same voices in every
scene. Yeah. Yeah. Which takes me back to this movie, Chuck Norris versus Communism, that I saw. It was really interesting how in Romania, apparently this woman was the only one who would do the translation, and so her voice became like the voice of the people. Like, her voice was as recognizable as the voice of the dictator who ran the country.
Wow.
And like, everybody knew her voice, and people had like fantasies about like what she would look like. You know, is she a beautiful blonde? Is she like an older brunette? Like, it was just this interesting, mysterious thing where like everybody knew.
So when you're watching these films, is it like, what is the picture that is being painted in your mind of what the United States is?
There's obvious like economic opportunities, more freedom, access to everything. But I would say the most important thing about American movies that was really exciting was sort of the positive, hopeful undertones of most of those movies, because the movies that were, you know, getting imported, they were like movies made for entertainment, so they were really like traditional American films with happy endings, and they were so exciting to see, because we were not only were we going through like really rough time as a country, but also the cinema that Russia was making at the time, because people filmmakers were censored for so long in the Soviet Union, and they were made forced to make this propaganda films for so long. So when censorship let up, they started to make just dark, dark, dark for the sake of darkness. Like, let's show dysfunction of everything and how every institution and every, you know, every idea is corrupt and everything ends badly. And so American films provided escape and
sure.
Also hope, like,
yeah,
we're going to make it. Maybe we'll make it.
Yeah. Did you see, were there any gay characters in anything, or was that just completely not spoken of?
It was definitely not spoken of for the longest time. And then there were, around the time that we left for the States, there were things kind of opening up. So I remember seeing Birdcage.
Don't use that tone to me.
What tone?
That sarcastic, contemptuous tone that means you know everything because you're a man and I know nothing because I'm a woman.
You're not a woman.
Oh, you bastard.
Which was super amazing to see. I remember seeing the government channel actually bought and officially translated My Own Private Idaho. I remember my mom recording My Own Private Idaho for me on VHS.
And describe that film.
It was just amazing. The one scene, the intimacy between River Phoenix and Keanu Reeves was so powerful to see, because it was like the first time that I saw, you know, two boys in love, and it was like portrayed as a beautiful thing. Or I don't know if they were in love, but mutually, but mm-hmm. At least you could tell that River Phoenix is in love with Keanu Reeves. And I don't know if I appreciated the film itself at the time, but that one image definitely was really, really incredible to see.
And did you know, oh, that's something that I am, or it's something?
Yeah, by that time I definitely knew. Yeah. Oh, you know, the homophobia in Russia was so overwhelming and daily and so violent, and combined with like my complete ignorance and not knowing anybody gay, you get so kind of removed from yourself, and from, you don't really understand at all like what it is that you are and what gay people really are and what that all means. And so seeing just a couple of images like that was like, it was helpful, but at the same time it wasn't enough to really kind of jolt me into any kind of self-awareness or being hopeful or anything. Like, it was just not enough. There were no gay bars as far as I knew. I didn't know any gay people. So it really felt like I was not, like I was the only one. In the,
right.
As the character on Little Britain says, the only gay in the village. But that's how like I felt all the time. But then seeing sometimes, you know, glimpses of Western media and seeing those images was, you know, it was still unclear, but it felt like, oh, maybe something going on abroad. Like maybe there's something happening. Maybe there's more gay people out there in other countries. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. they're just like,
they're all in America.
All the gay people, they've shipped them off.
Again, right before we left, for America, I remember on Channel 3, the Renegade channel, sometimes they would show just random music videos throughout the day. And they had a music video by Diana Ross, I think it was the obvious one, I Will Survive. Mm-hmm. And it was shot like a gay pride parade. That was definitely sort of things were connecting in my head, but not quite still, because it was like I wouldn't even know what a gay pride parade was. Like when you're so beat down and you're so like told that there's nothing like that out there, then it's kind of hard to even kind of accept that. Mm-hmm. Especially in a music video concept where it's not explained, but it kind of looked like, you know, oh, maybe there's like, looks like guys are making out and on the float, or, you know, I don't even remember the video. I don't remember exactly what I saw, but I remember it was a pride parade, and I was kind of almost figuring it out.
Right. You used to be that close.
I was like, what?
There's something here.
Yeah.
It's like a clue for something, like a mystery.
Something's going on. Yeah.
Wow. So how did you guys wind up getting out of Russia? And sorry, and I should also say, it's you and your mom and your dog, right?
Yeah, it's me, my mom, and my my dog. That was more like a little sister.
Mm-hmm.
She was named Windy, and everybody thought we were crazy for bringing her to the States because it was so hard. And yeah, so my mom ended up becoming sort of like a mail order bride. She was writing to this man in the States for many years. They were writing each other. Then he came to visit us in Russia. He stayed with us. Felt like a long time, maybe a couple of weeks.
And were they connected like through a mail order bride agency? Or
yeah, it was work? Kind of like, it was kind of like an ad in the newspaper, and she was also in like different catalogs, like mail order bride catalogs kind of thing, service things.
And was that just because she was like, this is my way to get out of Russia?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely, you know, getting out of Russia and also just giving up on Russian man in general.
Sure.
So then she visited him in the States after he came to visit us, and they got married secretly, and she came back and didn't really tell many people except me, and we started the process of, you know, getting visas in order and all that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So she, like, how fast was that process? Like, from I think, like, reaching out to him to getting married?
Oh, they were writing to each other for a long time. Mm-hmm. I feel like several years.
Okay. So it wasn't just like, bam, we're married.
No. They were friends, well, like, pen pals for a long time. And then he visited us, and she visited him for a while, I think, like a month.
Mm-hmm. Did you get along with him?
So at first, I really got along with him. Then it turned out when we came to the States, it turned out he was like hardcore religious fundamentalist and really, really nutty religious fundamentalist. And so there was a lot of clashing. I don't know. It was complicated because I couldn't really be a rebellious teenager and just be like, fuck off, because he would just send us back to Russia, and that was not an option.
Mm. And what, like, the process of getting out of Russia is not just like, all right, I'm going to get a plane ticket and we're going to leave. I mean, it's a complicated thing, right?
Yeah, it was very complicated. I mean, we had to go. There was so much paperwork. And even on the Russian side, there's so much paperwork for them to let you out of the country. Like, there's all this stuff that you have to do.
Yeah, I mean, like, just you're really stuck, not just in Russia, but in Vladivostok, right?
Yeah. So we had to go to Moscow, to the embassy, to get our, you know, paperwork to come to the States. And which was kind of, it was a crazy, stressful thing to try to find money to go to Moscow all of a sudden, but I'm kind of glad I saw Moscow before we left.
Was it like just a huge change from where you'd grown up?
It was definitely, I mean, it's still messed up. It's still Russia, but it definitely had more, you know, it's a big cosmopolitan city. So a lot of things that we were not used to. We came back to Vladivostok for a little bit, and then we went straight to the States, and that was super exciting.
Where'd you settle down?
We ended up leaving right by the Troll, under the Fremont or Aurora Bridge.
And, like, literally, there's a troll who lives under the bridge. It's not lives under the bridge. It's a statue of a troll.
It's a really smelly troll because people pee on him all the time.
Oh, God.
It's actually, people don't know how disgusting that troll is. Like, they let their children play with it. I would not. It should be bleached.
Oh, God. Yeah, so it's this great, it's the Fremont Troll. It's actually one of the first things that we looked at when we moved to Seattle. Before we even moved to Seattle, we were just visiting.
You're like, troll.
And yeah, I know, it's so cool. There's a bridge with a troll, like this giant concrete troll underneath it. And so you lived like just like down the street from it?
Yeah, like on this, like right by it. Yeah, wow. The apartment building was right by it. And it's also the other... The other thing that made that place famous is at one point there was a bus. There was a crazy guy on a bus on Aurora Bridge who shot the driver.
Okay.
And the bus plunged from the bridge and fell onto our neighbors. Like we literally came back from a movie. And there's like reporters on our lawn. And there's a bus sticking out of our neighbor's apartment building.
Oh, my God. So here you are. You finally landed in this country that you've always seen in the movies and everything. And what was it like?
It was amazing. It was like, I think Quentin Crisp has a quote that he said, the United States is better than in any movie. You know, I'm not quoting it right, but it's the thought is like it, you know, was better than any of his expectations even. And that's how we felt because it was so... Yeah, it was so wonderful in every way.
Mm-hmm. Did it met your expectations?
It definitely met our expectations and more because it was real. Mm-hmm. Because it's kind of when you're, you know, dreaming it, you don't really know what it's going to be like. And it was actually happening to us and it was real. And
yeah, you're not like watching it through this fuzzy black and white TV set.
Yeah.
So how did you explore? Like, what did you start to look into when you got here?
I remember... My first night was really exciting because we just, I just slept with the door open. We had a big like slide out window or door out to the outside and I slept right by it. And it just felt really good and freeing and kind of safe. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, I know nothing is safe, but like comparing to Russia, it was so safe. Mm-hmm. And the next day I remember going to Gasworks Park and just like laying on the grass there and just taking in everything and just because it was kind of almost hard to process, like for several years it didn't really feel quite real yet. And like for my mom, she still doesn't feel like it's real sometimes, like she's afraid to like wake up back in Russia, you know?
Sure.
I remember just, you know, just walking around, and we were lucky because we moved straight to Seattle, which is like so gorgeous, and Fremont, which was, I mean, I don't know if it still is, but was an amazing neighborhood and so beautiful and artsy and mellow and friendly.
Was that, did they have there at the time the giant statue of Lenin?
Yeah, they had it.
So it's like in the middle of town for some reason.
It's so bizarre. Yeah. It's so bizarre, yeah. A lot of people, like my mom hates it. I feel like it's a beautiful... punishment for Lenin to be surrounded by capitalism.
That's true. like and, all these stores around,
you know, like what is it, Taco Del Mar behind it, and picture, you know, every tourist is taking pictures. Like, I think that's great. I hope he's trapped in that statue.
That's wonderful. It's a little, yeah, a little, take that.
Yeah.
So did you start to see more like gay culture? Like, did you start to be like, oh, now I'm in the place where there's other gay people?
Yeah, so definitely that kind of overtook my life and my existence, because so my stepfather, even though he was, you know, very conservative and religious, he was also really good in some ways, and he was really interested in me like learning computer skills really right away, because, you know, computers were completely new to me. So he got me a computer, he got me hooked up to the internet. And of course, as soon as I got on the internet, I started to figure stuff out, and I I became so... I mean, I think part of it is that age when you're a teenager and you're just angry. But I was just so extra special angry because I felt like, you know, all this gay history was taken away from me. And just the thought that I was made to feel so terrible, like so terrible that, you know, you're like on the brink of ending your own life, which I'm sure how every gay person feels in a place like Russia. And you're taking away all this gay history and the fact that so many people who like created our civilization are gay, but we don't know that. And that just made me so pissed. So I was educating myself all day, every day, you know.
Oh, wow,
I was just reading up on gay rights and gay history. And of course, that only made me more angry. Because, yeah, and it made me more angry because I wanted to, like, now that I knew exactly what, you know, that there's gay history, that there's a gay community, that you can be open here, I really wanted to come out. You know, in that age, you, like, want to fall in love and get laid, and you're just, like, so fixated on that. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, I was like, that can actually happen to me. Like, I can actually have a future where I fall in love with somebody, you know, mutually. So that was such an amazing, radical idea, and I really wanted to just, like, jump right into it, but I couldn't because my stepfather was so religious, conservative, that I was afraid he would just kick us out.
Right.
And so I started, my mom noticed that I was, you know, really acting strange, and so she kept confronting me, and finally I came out to her. And she was really funny. She was amazing. She took it so well. I mean, I still don't know. My mom is really interesting because of how, she's literally, like, unlike anybody I knew growing up. She's so, like, not racist, not anti-Semitic, not homophobic, and everybody else around us, including our own family, were. Mm. So, like, I don't know why she is the way she is, but I'm super lucky. But, yeah, her reaction was really funny because she was like, oh, everybody's a little gay. To which, like, at first I was happy that she was upset. Then I was, like, upset that she wasn't, like, are you taking it seriously? I was like, I'm really gay. No, I'm, like, super gay.
It's not just like I'm actually gay. It's not like the
And she's
bit.
Like, no, I'm so happy for you. Like, I was so worried why you're depressed and why, you know, why you were acting weird, and this is great. And she was so supportive. And so my poor mom, because she was the only person I could talk to, I subjected her to, like, hours and hundreds of thousands of hours of, like, gay history that I would just regurgitate to her. Bless her heart.
But you still probably have to keep it secret from the stepfather, right?
Yeah, so we kept it from the stepfather. My mom found creative ways to sort of help me out. Like, I remember her taking me to see In-N-Out when In-N-Out came out.
And that was like 96, 97.
And the stepfather was so angry.
Oh, no.
And she was like, oh, I didn't know. What's, like, she just pretended she didn't know what gay was. Like, she was just pretending to be, which is easy because, you know, we were learning English. She was just kind of playing dumb. And like, oh, I don't know what this is about. Oh, so sorry. You know, and then she had this massage therapist at her job who was lesbian and had a lesbian partner. Mm-hmm. And so my mom basically, like, hooked me up with them, said, you know, you go hang out with them a lot, you know, which was so good and healthy for me to experience, like, this older, well-adjusted gay couple.
Was that the first, like, gay couple that you had access to, that you'd
meet? Yeah. Yeah, that was. That was so, that was really amazing. Hmm.
Did you see a future for yourself starting to unfold in front of you?
Definitely, yeah. And, you know, if I could go back and, like, tell myself to be patient, but again, because, like, you're young and you're, you know, going through all the hormones and stuff, mm-hmm. you're just, it's so intense. And I was just like, I couldn't wait, and I was angry and depressed and upset and, like, torn. And
did you find other, like, were there other gay people your own age?
Found out about Lambert House, which is a support, like, a place that supports gay youth in Seattle. And the first time I tried to go there, I got lost and ended up in a cemetery and found a grave of Bruce Lee, and I was, like, crying because I thought I would never make it out. And this was before cell phones. So I was just wandering around everywhere. Like, I was like,
just like lost, couldn't... wandering a cemetery.
Yeah. And finally, some guy, like, barely, you know, my English wasn't great, and, like, barely, he kind of explained to me where to go, and I finally made it home. And then I tried again, and finally I got to Lambert House, and that was, I don't know, I had mixed feelings about it, because I think they're an amazing organization, and they help out so many kids, but the kids that I met were so different from me. Like, there were a lot of homeless kids who have, like, super abusive parents who kicked them out, and they're trans on top of it. And so I was really happy that this organization exists, but it was definitely not the place where I would, like, find my next boyfriend, which is really what I wanted, or, like, find people like me. And then, you know, the challenge of being an immigrant on top of it, which I really realize now, like, that was a huge part of it, too, is, like, you know, when the language barrier on top of being gay, it becomes so complicated, and, like, it's so hard to meet people and, like, really have a conversation.
You mentioned wanting to meet people who were like you. What were you like?
I don't know. I mean, what was I like? I don't know.
Or what's the person that you would have wanted to have met?
Somebody, like, masculine, attractive, or even not attractive, just, like, gay people who are well-adjusted, who kind of have their life together, who are, like, strong, not physically strong, but, like, just, you know, they know who they are and they're...
Confident.
Yeah, Lambert House was definitely not that, because it was, like, a place for, you know, kids who are really in trouble and, like...
So it sounds like there's... like, on the spectrum of people who really, like, things were dire for them. There were the kids at Lambert House, and then there was you still searching for what kind of gay am I, and where's my place in the world? And you're looking for the people who are at the far end of the spectrum, who have figured it out, like that lesbian couple, but you need more than just a lesbian couple.
Yeah, I mean, I remember my first sort of huge gay crush. We worked together, so this was my first job. And I run into this guy, and he's, like, cute and completely just a regular guy. You know, like, you would never be able to tell that he's gay. But completely open, like, super gay. So, like, the first thing... I feel like the first thing that came out of his mouth was that he's gay. Like, he was just really, really... active in the gay community, and was, like, really pushing the gay agenda, which was awesome, really brave. So in many ways, like, it was my first crush, but he was really my first sort of, like, a real life role model in a way, or, like, somebody to look up to be like, or not even to look up to, but just as a model, like, oh, this is possible for me, like, I can just be me, but, like, completely open about who I am.
You mentioned, like, confidence and bravery. It sounds like that's something that you really wanted to aspire to.
Well, I think I was so, you know, I was just so angry at myself for, like, not being able to come out yet because of my stepfather. And, like, coming out was important to me. And just kind of reading up all the gay theory and gay history made me really militant. But as soon as I moved out from my parents and I came out and I just...
What was that coming out like?
I came out to my coworkers who were totally accepting. I remember I came out to my only friend in high school, which was really depressing because she apparently had a crush on me this whole time. And with my stepfather, like, we never really had a conversation, but it was kind of a obvious thing that he figured out. Like, and then the other huge thing that happened, you know, when I moved out, my stepfather started to change and become open to things like Halloween. I remember that was really radical thing for us because Halloween was Satan's holiday. And then...
So very fundamentalist.
Yeah, and then one day he shows up to my new apartment on Halloween with mom, and they bring a pumpkin to carve, and they bring, like, a bee horror movie to watch. And I was so excited and just kind of wondering what's going on with him. And so... And then one day my mom called crying, just saying that apparently she came home and James was my stepfather's name, was in women's clothing and introduced herself as Janice, as her female name, and told her her life story and how she was really repressed and wanted to marry a Russian woman because for whatever reason she thought that Russian woman will be like help her repress those things. And so it ended up being kind of an awesome thing where like he helped us escape from Russia, and I think my mom's openness and like really being so warm and supportive of everything made Janice come out. So kind of worked out for everybody.
Yeah, gosh, it sounds like he helped you and then you helped him in a way like nobody could have anticipated.
Yeah,
they'd be helping each other.
Yeah, so Janice since then like had a sex change, completely lived her life as a woman until her death. And
gosh, so and it kind of explains like that repression that you were feeling is something that she must have been feeling too, and also was keeping
secret. Yeah, it's definitely now I'm extra, you know, that whole stereotype about people who are homophobic that they're repressed, like now I'm so biased towards that. Like I instantly think that if somebody's homophobic, I'm like, you have something to hide.
Yeah. Wow. I assume your relationship changed a lot after James became Janice.
You know, we kept in touch. We weren't like, you know, super close friends, but we definitely kept in touch, and Janice came to see like my movies a lot of the time. We were friends on Facebook. Her and my mom stayed roommates for a while and like lived together, and my mom kind of became like a tranny sidekick because Janice had this bunch of like drag queens and trans people who would go out to, I think that bar is not around anymore, but it was a karaoke bar, and they would karaoke and my mom would film them. So that was going on for a while. And then finally, you know, they separated and...
Sure, well, things
but
have
it was,
changed.
It was totally amicable, and it was really a nice mutual kind of...
Boy, oh boy, it must have really tested your mom, like... There's a lot of people in her life who are expressing their gender in ways that she might not have anticipated.
Yeah, it's in a way I'm glad it happened for me and for Janice. I'm glad that it happened, you know, that we had mom in our life because she's so supportive, and it could have been really different. You know, and she was super supportive of James, and you know, through her transition to Janice, but at the same time, she definitely had a complex for a while about... She would literally suspect anybody she's dating of being... Like, she just became paranoid. I was like... It would tell me, like, oh, I went out on a date with this guy, but his nails were kind of long, you know? And she would just kind of... And I was like, really, Mom, the chance of you, like, marrying another transgender person are, like, slim. Winning a lottery. Yeah. Like, you're not gonna... But it was definitely kind of, you know, stuck with her for a while.
So, gosh, wow. And so this gradual experience of James exploring, like, what else can I be? Am I Janice? That was coinciding with you exploring, you know, what does it mean for me to be a gay man? And what does the world look like for gay men? And so you started going to, you went to college in the area.
I went to UW, yeah. That was awesome, but I was, I feel like being an immigrant and also going, like, I was just so shy. I'm not really a shy person anymore, I don't think, but I was, like, pathologically shy where I would, like, some days would not want to go outside and see people. I was just so uncomfortable. Being an immigrant, like, exasperated that, made me super self-conscious, and, you know, my English wasn't that great. So I think the first few years in college, like, I wasn't really doing all the things that I could have been doing and, like, really exploring or, like, having all those different experiences in life because I was just trying to kind of learn the English and...
Sure. So what started to change? How did you get used to going out and being more part of the world?
I think it was kind of parallel to me. Like, the more I assimilated, the more... the better my English got. You know, and as soon as I got to that point where I could really have a comfortable conversation and that completely, you know, any conversation I want with anybody and not and having language not be a barrier, that was huge. Like, my best friend kind of, who was an artist, kind of became, in a way, my mentor. in an art world, just kind of a role model, and we're like, how do I live my life as an artist, and how do I?
Well, tell me a little more about that. Like, who? How did you meet, and what did he mentor you?
It wasn't like an official mentoring, but it was kind of. So he, and he's also my muse in all of my projects, Waxy Moon. Mm-hmm. But his real name is Mark, and Mark and I met back in college, and he was my teacher. He was a grad student at UW, and he was my first acting teacher. Mm-hmm. And you know, we kept in touch and we're kind of friends, and then gradually became better friends. He co-founded a really popular theater in Seattle, and I kind of became part of that and was filming all of their shows.
And what were you studying at UW?
I double majored in drama and visual arts, like in interdisciplinary visual arts. Like,
but you were doing a lot of camera work with Waxy, who's like this great Seattle drag queen.
Yeah, well, so Mark was not Waxy yet. And that was kind of a thing that, you know, as of kind of was happening at the same time, or you know, we became best friends around the same time that Mark was exploring burlesque and got into burlesque, and his persona is sort of a gender bending persona in burlesque, so I got to witness that
creation, you know,
that creation gradually.
Describe what Waxy Moon looks like.
So Waxy Moon now looks like a really beautiful, graceful, bald man with a handlebar mustache in women's clothing who channels a kind of theatrical femininity. And
so you, like, how long did you know Mark, you know, before Waxy started to become a presence?
Several years. I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years. And then I remember, you know, he told me he took some classes, some burlesque classes. And I, it's funny because burlesque is such a huge part of my life now, but I didn't really know what burlesque was. And I thought of burlesque more as an aesthetic, as a sort of bright, colorful, like vaudeville circus inspired aesthetic, more than, like a performance, like a genre of performance. So I kind of learned all of that by watching him and then being exposed to all of his friends and...
Oh, wow. So you're like getting into the burlesque world.
Yeah. And so I got, you know, I got into it through him and just completely fell in love with it. And at this, around the same time, you know, I got my first, well, I had my first camera and I was doing videography, a lot of videography for friends. And that's how I kind of learned to use the camera. And, we just had this idea of like, oh, I should do a documentary on Waxy Moon because he's just such a fascinating persona. And Mark at the time was obsessed with this movie. I feel like it's called Showboy, which is kind of a mockumentary about a male show, a showboy, not a male showboy. And so at first there was going to be a mockumentary, and then for a couple of years, I went to so many shows and I interviewed so many of the women in burlesque, and I just totally fell in love with the community in Seattle and some of the performers from New York. So it unintentionally became like a serious documentary that's very anthropological. Like I'm very happy that I made it at the time that I made it, because the Seattle community was really blowing up and it was really kind of a very special moment in the community at the time.
So it captures what the performance world here was like?
Was like, yeah.
What around was that it like? Time.
It was just really thriving. There was a bunch of people who were super talented who were all working together constantly. Like each one of them kind of had their own show, and then they would, you know, all of them would be in that show, and then all of them would be in each other's shows. And
so it was just all working together. And this
it was like a small world, but really just the talent was so incredible. It really made me feel like it's sort of a small, you know, it's like a moment, like a grunge or a punk or like Harlem Renaissance or something, where it's like, oh, this is, people are going to look back and like recognize it in academia as like a moment for something.
What was the title of that?
It was just called Waxy Moon.
Okay.
So it's primarily about Mark, but I did end up, you know, just talking about burlesque in general and gender and burlesque a lot. So there's a lot of people.
Like, this seems like it's like a really big project for you to like bite off as like your first big thing.
Yeah, it kind of just, you know, it. I didn't really know what I was doing or what I was starting, and then it just kept going. I kept filming shows.
Mm-hmm. And then before you knew it, you have a feature documentary.
Yeah. And before I knew it, I was like, oh, we don't need to like make it a mockumentary. We don't need to fake or stage anything. It's actually really... Mm-hmm. I kind of let it become what it needed to become. It was not the movie that I intended to make, but...
So where'd you go from there? What was your next project?
So through that, we became even closer with Mark, and we just hung out so much and talking about movies and art. And, you know, I'm super obsessed with Waxy Moon as a character, and we really wanted to make something that's a fictional narrative, mm-hmm, centered around Waxy. And especially exploring gender in different genres of film, like iconic feminine characters in Hollywood films throughout time. And so we talked about it for a while, came up with a bunch of ideas, and then checked into a hotel and wrote the screenplay like over a weekend. And that was my first feature.
What was that?
So that was called Waxy Moon and Fallen Jewel.
I was in love with life, but the feeling wasn't mutual. He was easy on the eyes, but not on the heart.
The concept of the movie is like the her place in her life dictates the genre of the film. So when she's single, she's living in this like Sex in the City parody. Mm-hmm. And then she gets married and it becomes a Douglas Sirk like married, well, actually a widow. Like a Douglas Sirk melodrama. Uh-huh. And then at the end it's kind of a victim thing, and it's a sexploitation film.
Oh gosh. Okay. So she goes through all these different phases and genres.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're not just exploring with, like, you're not just playing with the story of this character, but you're also fiddling around with, like, different types of movies.
Yeah, I love any kind of genre bending. Mm-hmm. That always is really exciting to me.
Like, growing up, you had a lot of access to sort of, like, these bubblegum sort of movies. And, so... how much was that? Did you find that infusing your own work? Like that influence of Curly Sue and I don't know, My Own Private Idaho, which isn't really bubblegum.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think ironically, that is definitely not where I'm coming from as an artist now. Like, mm-hmm, now I'm actually hearkening back to like really terrible, not terrible, but like really low budget Russian films that I saw.
Oh, wow. Really?
Which, because I'm like a no-budget, you know, super guerrilla kind of filmmaker, mm-hmm, those types of films are more of a model for me, because it's like, you know, like we had all this like terribly low-budget musicals in Russia, like kids' movies where like adult people would play animals. And that was like totally a norm, like suspend your disbelief. And we did suspend our disbelief, and... you know, at the time I didn't appreciate it, but now I'm like, it's all sort of part of kind of indie ethic of like, just make a movie that you can make. Right. DIY. Don't wait for money. Yeah,
exactly. So how'd you get from Fallen Jewel to Capitol Hill?
Yeah, so we, I mean, I was so, you know, I'm still really super inspired by Waxy Moon, and the idea of creating something serial that could be ongoing, mm-hmm, was really exciting. And plus, I'm a huge fan of like terrible 70s. Well, I don't think they're even terrible. I mean, they are a little bit, but you know, 70s shows like Charlie's Angels and Murder, She Wrote, and like, Remington Steele and Dynasty and Dallas and all of those things.
And these are things like the movies you were watching that like really make up mass American culture of a certain time period.
Yeah, and I just love the how formulaic the writing is in those shows. Yeah. And just everything about them is so specific. You know, there's a very specific way, the way they're shot and the way they're edited and the way the stories are written.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of found it inspiring in a way that's like to take this really queer character of Waxy, or not, Waxy is actually playing Roses, so it's not quite her character, but to take all those queer performers and put them in this world, but still make it look as much as what it's aspiring to be as possible.
Describe what Capitol Hill is and how it functions and what it looks like.
So Capitol Hill is a web series that's 2 seasons long. The second season is about to come out. The first season has been out for a year. It's, you know, about 10 minute episodes. It's structured to be very much reminiscent of 70s and 80s TV shows.
Get in.
You don't even know where I'm going.
I know a pretty young girl shouldn't be walking along a dirt road by herself.
My name's Roses. I'm going to Seattle.
Well, it's your lucky day, Roses, because that's where I'm going.
So Seattle, huh?
The biggest, greatest, most beautiful city in the world.
True that. There isn't a better place in the world than Seattle. It isn't called the center of the universe for nothing. I'm going there on account of my new job.
Now, what brings you to Seattle?
Dreams.
Oh, you're the dreamer type, huh?
My mom always said, no point in living unless you follow every dream you got.
Smart mama. Where's she now?
She drowned herself in the river when I was a wee child.
It revolves around Rose's smell, this innocent. In my mind, she's 16 years old. A girl from Portland who comes to Seattle and gets a job on television. And the catch is, and I don't remember why I thought that was funny when we came up with the idea, but the catch is that Seattle is like the biggest city in the world. It's like the center of the universe. It's amazing. It's like New York and Sex and the City, like just glamour and money and
it's the culmination everything, of all your dreams.
Everything happens here. And Portland is basically like backwater, inbred, terrible, like Confederate flag. It's deep south because it's south of Seattle. So it's like deep south.
Yeah, if your whole world is the Pacific Northwest, that's the south.
So it's kind of like Deliverance, like meets like Southern Gothic. I'm really a big fan of like Flannery O'Connor and just like really outrageous, like Southern Gothic like archetypes that she created, but like taken to the next level where they're like mutants and they're all inbred and they're cannibals and
so a bit beyond Flannery O'Connor.
Just a little bit. So yeah, so it's I kind of describe it as like Dynasty, like a queer Dynasty meets a little bit of Twin Peaks, because there's a supernatural underlining, kind of dark supernatural undertone that's happening at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And where did you encounter Dynasty and Twin Peaks? Like, was that after you came to the U.S.?
Some things we were, you know, so when the Soviet Union opened up, there were some things that were imported. So a lot of things I didn't see until now, but some random. It's amazing how random those things are, like Remington Steele was imported, but not Charlie's Angels. Like, I've never heard of Charlie's Angels until I came here. Dynasty, we did not see. Dallas, they started to show Dallas in Russia, and then they stopped. That was really cruel.
Oh, no.
They like, I was like, we'll never find out who killed him.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was like, they showed, like, 5 episodes.
It's like a national trauma.
It was really upsetting.
Oh, my God.
But when we came here, I was really, one of the things that I was really fixated on is like catching up on popular culture. So I would watch a lot of stuff that like, even stuff that like my generation wouldn't necessarily even be into here, but like I was just so interested in like what shows would have my grandma would have watched if she like was born here, you know. Like I was, and I'm still fascinated with, you know, kind of older American pop culture. So I watched, you know, stuff like Charlie's Angels and Columbo and stuff like that.
You know, it wasn't until a few years ago that I discovered Murder, She Wrote. I mean, I always knew about it, but I was always like, eh, I'm not interested. And then I watched it maybe like 5 or 6 years ago, and I was like, oh my God, how have I lived my whole life without watching this show?
It's so bad and good.
That's the thing. It's like
the murders are so dumb. I mean,
it's so dumb, and I love it. Same thing like Remington Steele and Columbo and all those things that are like, oh, he's going to do the just one more thing again.
Yeah.
It's so dumb, and yet there's just this real pleasure. And, you know, part of it might also be that the TV, like, we just didn't watch TV in my house when I was growing up. We watched the news, and maybe we'd watch, like, old Looney Tunes cartoons, and that was, like, about it.
Was it, like, a deliberate choice on the part of your parents?
It was very, like, we're not going to have any television. And we, like, seldom went to the movies. So, you know, I wonder if maybe we're experiencing the same thing.
Yeah.
Got a lot of catching up to do.
Yeah.
I only just saw Mad Max for, like, the first Mad Max.
The first one, yeah.
I saw it yesterday. That was the first time I've ever seen it. And sometimes, like, that catching up is great, and you're like, oh my God, Mad Max, this is amazing, because it's a great movie.
Yeah.
But then James recently showed me Hudson Hawk, and I was like, oh.
Oh my God. Hudson Hawk. I just saw Sandra Bernhard live, and it was kind of embarrassing, because I basically went in to see Sandra Bernhard, having only seen her in Hudson Hawk to it. So I was like, oh my God, she's so talented. Like, she can sing so well. And everybody's like, yeah, actually. And I was like, well, I've only seen her in Hudson Hawk and, like, what was that Isaac Mizrahi documentary? Like, she's kind of like, I just thought of her as like, oh, she's like a socialite who fucked Madonna. And, like, you know, like, she's everywhere, but she's not really somebody who's like amazing, but she's amazing.
She's great. She's fantastic. And I will say, like, of all the things in Hudson Hawk, she's a highlight. But she's also, you know, she's on Roseanne as like the lesbian friend in Roseanne, and she's, God, I mean, like, she's just, as a stand-up, she's just like this incredible storyteller. She's this amazing presence. She was Kathy Griffin before Kathy Griffin was Kathy Griffin.
Yeah.
Which is unfair to say. Kathy Griffin's always been Kathy Griffin. But, I mean, I feel like Sandra Bernhard really, like, opened the door. So, like, we're discovering these things, and we're like,
oh. Hudson Hawk was one of the first American movies that I saw, actually, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I'm so sorry.
I know.
But, you know, it's like a lot of those things. It's just fun. It's fun and stupid. And
yeah.
I love that you're, like, infusing that stuff into your work now and being, like, really creative and clever and deliberate about it. You know, you see those influences, like the way that Capitol Hill opens with Ben de la Creme, like, addressing the camera, like,
Oh, hello, treasures, and welcome to Seattle, Washington, the greatest city in the world. My name is Ben de la Creme, and I'm so excited to welcome you into my home.
Yeah, that was a thing on a lot of episodes of Murder, She Wrote. Where, do you remember, like, around episode, season two or so, she started, like, opening this episode by, like, directly talking to the camera?
I think I saw that once.
There were a bunch of them where she's like, she just turns to the camera and she's like, now I'm going to tell you a story about my friend so-and-so who moved to Los Angeles. And then, like, Jessica Fletcher's not even in the episode. And it's this weird, like, framing device. Anyway, like, that's exactly what Ben does in Capitol Hill. Do you feel like you're caught up on culture now? Or are you still like, oh my God, there's more. I gotta see this. I gotta see this.
Oh, there's so much more. Yeah. Well, with television, I feel like we're living in a really exciting time when television is really... and by television, I just mean HBO. It's, like, really amazing where, like, everything that HBO puts out, I want to see because the quality of writing is so good. And then with television and movies, I'm so drawn to, like, older stuff. I don't know what it is. It's some kind of weird pseudo-nostalgia for stuff that, like, I didn't have. So I'm like, I'm so interested in stuff that's like 80s back.
Yeah.
Back all the way to like silent film. Like that's so much more interesting to me than like going to see new movies generally.
Mm-hmm. I feel the same way, yeah.
I'm never caught up. Like, because there's thousands of them. If all I do is watch movies, I'll die not having seen all of them, you know?
Right. Well, there's just so much. But it's also a real pleasure because you're never going to run out.
Yeah.
It's never like, I've seen everything new that's out right now.
It's so true. Like,
fuck what's new.
And then there's Bollywood, which I also want to catch up on.
Oh my God, there's so much good. And now you're not just watching it because you're consuming it and then you're spitting it right back out in your own work.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's so... Yeah, it's super exciting for inspiration too. especially it all feels like work. Like, I can justify, like, I watched the first season of Falcon Crest, which was just so terrible. Mm-hmm. Such a terrible show, but I totally don't feel like I wasted any time because it helped me with editing Capitol Hill and mm-hmm. just figuring out the structure of it.
What does it feel like to see that world? Like, how do you feel about the thing that you're creating?
It's amazing. It's amazing because I've fantasized about making films, like, being really, really little. Like, I remember in daycare, I didn't get in trouble, but, like, my adults would, like, talk to my mom because I would try to, like, I would organize all the kids into, like, design costumes and, like, make all the sketches for, like, sets and things. And they were like, how, he's not gonna make a movie, like, there's no camera, like, I would never even see a camera. But I was just, like, determined. I wasn't even thinking about, like, how am I gonna get there. I was like, I'm gonna try to do this. And then as I got older, I was like, oh, I'll never be able to do this. Like, it was really sad, but I was still always making movies in my head. So when I finally, you know, came here and realized, like, it's possible, and now to actually be making stuff and, like, knowing that I can, at least on my own very lo-fi level, I can make anything I want, that's, like, really incredible. I mean, I think that's the biggest, most amazing thing that came out of me, like, coming here, is being able to, like, follow that dream, you know.
And if people want to see the work that you've done, where can they find it?
So Waxing Moon, both the documentary Waxing Moon and Fallen Jewel, the feature, they're available either as DVD or streamable. Fallen Jewel is available on Amazon, a bunch of retailers, as DVD, streamable, on Vimeo, on iTunes. I think it's going to come out on Netflix very soon. And Capitol Hill is just, it's on YouTube, it's on Vimeo, it's on Huffington Post, it's on, what is that site? Not What the Funny. Funny or Die.
Okay. I like What the Funny.
What the Funny, yeah. So
it's everywhere. Just search for Capitol Hill and you'll find it.
Yeah, and we'll be releasing the second season soon.
Awesome. Wes, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Big thanks to Wes for joining me and also for creating the insanely great show Capitol Hill. Season 2 just premiered on YouTube and you'd be a fool, an absolute fool, to miss it. The show follows the ongoing drama of a small-town girl, played by a big, tall man, as she struggles with fame and fortune and demon possession. And beneath that zany surface, Wes's work is an amazing amalgamation of pop cultural styles, inspected and deconstructed and reconstituted into a web series that is simultaneously nostalgic and innovative. One moment you feel like you're watching a 70s drama, the next it's a modern-day thriller, then it's a drag show, then there's a room full of undulating naked men, and the whole thing is oh so very queer. Knowing Wes's past with American culture makes the series even more special. It's not just a screwy comedy that borrows from pop culture tropes, it's a love letter to the tropes themselves. Thanks again for listening. If you have any thoughts on today's show, please get in touch. Tweet at me, at Matt Baume. You can check out the show notes for a list of all the stuff we talked about on today's show, with videos and links and commentary, at sewersofparis.com. And please keep rating and reviewing the show in the iTunes store. Those reviews make a huge difference. Thanks to Guy and Alameda, who writes, Matt is a terrific interviewer and has amazing guests. The movies and TV shows referenced bring back great memories. Well, that is really great to hear, and please don't hesitate to share your own memories that the show calls up. Tweet at me, at Matt Baume. Check out my YouTube channel for videos about LGBT issues and entertainment. That's youtube.com/Matt Baume. And take a listen to my other podcast, Defining Marriage. It's based on my book of the same title that traces the decades-long evolution of marriage through previously untold struggles of those who lived through it. Each week I'm releasing one chapter of the audiobook, complete and unabridged, plus tons of bonus content. Untold personal stories, interviews with people whose lives were forever changed by the fight for marriage, and truly strange cultural references. This week, my guests include Barney Frank and Robbie Kaplan. And until next time, croissant.